Blog Talk Radio.
I still hate this place, and I don't like it. There's just too many people that went through here that what they learned was violence, hate, resentment, and frustration. And they'll carry that through for the rest of their lives. I am an everyday Lakota man. I live in a small community of Wounded Knee on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. Slowly I realized the experience in the government boarding school had kept me in a place where I couldn't seem to go forward, backwards, or sideways.
Now the secret is starting to be revealed in the communities, and we're really seeing the extent of this abuse. The Indian boarding schools were part of a misguided effort to try to assimilate Indians into the American cultural and social mainstream. Children are the core of any family, but especially Indian families. And so the attack on the children and on the Indian families was deliberate and effective.
It took my mother and father away.
And
I didn't want them to
leave. Got me down in this real strange chair.
I had to run.
It got me scared.
The matrons called
me. I just started seeing my hair fall on the floor.
Who died for the cutting all our hair?
We had all our clothes taken from us.
And being hungry. I remember being hungry, always going to bed hungry.
We were being punished, but none of us really knew why.
It wasn't punishment, it was beatings. We got beat, there's just about everything.
You put your hands there and they slammed the desk down on your hands.
Be handcuffed to the bedstead.
They take you downstairs and make you kneel down on either a broom handle.
Soap. That's what she used to wash my mouth.
Or a pencil. Man,
I'll never forget the burning, the choking, the helplessness, the fading out that I went through.
It wasn't until my 60th year that I began to realize there was more to me. Something was missing. It was like I was a non-being. I didn't know the medical words of multi-generational trauma or the complex post-traumatic stress disorder. So I called the problem what I felt it to be, the thick, dark fog.
So we started writing down his memories. And shortly into it, he reached a block where he had started talking about his boarding school years. And he couldn't keep talking.
It's important that people understand why Indian country is the way it is, why there is all of this social pathology going on in these communities. Like, you can draw a straight line from the boarding schools to alcoholism, substance abuse, the exploitation of children, and violence against women in the Indian community.
Today, Amnesty International releases a report that should disturb every American. Native American and Alaska Native women experience shockingly high rates of rape and sexual assault.
I know I slapped my wife around a number of times, but I've always felt bad afterwards. But it didn't do any good, because it's a behavior that you're not aware of. You don't know it's there. It just happens. Something will set you off. Something will trigger that.
We went to his doctor at the VA hospital. And his doctor said, keep talking. As painful as it is, the key is to keep talking.
There's some people here in this community that are really, you know, healing themselves. There's a movement. In Lakota, we say, Dakushkaska. It means that something's moving.
Please welcome Walter Littlemoon.
We still have a long ways to go. Every project that we've developed was more or less a setup for developing self or self-confidence, a little respect, which was completely destroyed. There was too much drinking, people were dying.
I'm sharing this because so many people living on this reservation and other reservations across the continent still suffer from these things And I want them to know that it's possible to be free, to gain contentment, and to be a human being.
Life on the Pine Ridge Reservation, in terms of pride, and really in terms of the quality of life, is better because of that man, isn't it?
Now I stand before you. This is my sweat lodge. This is my vision. This is my sun dance.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Fire Talk Productions. This is Russ Lenica, your host, and this is Fire Talk. Joining me today is co-host David Illegal and Nell Cole, also the producer. We're humbled today to have with us Randy Vasquez. Randy Vasquez is an American actor who's also a director of some very amazing documentaries and stories that need to be told. excuse me. Currently, he just finished filming The Thick Dark Fog. It took 7 years in its making, and it's projected to be released in the spring of 2012. He also produced one of a story of an activist, Maria. I'm looking up her name right now. I had it on the tip of my tongue.
It's Maria Guardado.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, David, for jumping in there. Thank you. So I do want to open up with that, but first we want to get Randy on the air, and we want him to get to explain himself a little bit to us. Let's get into the stories of these documentaries that he's produced. So, Randy, welcome to Fire Talk.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Randy, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and where you started, and who are you?
Yeah, well, I'm a guy who is... I just turned 50, so I spent a lot of my life trying to deal with my identity, some identity issues as far as my ethnic identity, that being, you know, my mother's a white woman, my father is Mexican from northern Mexico, and it took me about almost 30 years to reconcile, accept, and embrace the brown side of me, the Mexican side of me. And maybe for those reasons, I wanted to become an actor. I wanted to get to know who I was in some maybe a buried way. And I've been here in Los Angeles and New York pursuing that. And I've been fortunate enough to get a lot of work. In the mid-90s, I started off in 1980, mid-90s, something clicked inside of me, and I just kind of got sick and tired of thinking about just me and getting an acting job, and I started volunteering in the community here in Los Angeles. I started thinking of the bigger picture of maybe people less fortunate or something like that, and my life journey, I met this woman, Maria Guardado, who was a Salvadoran immigrant who got political asylum here, like many Salvadorans during the early 1980s, as they were fleeing the civil war in El Salvador, also in Guatemala. And long story short, I ended up making this documentary about this woman's life and struggle. She had been kidnapped by the Salvadoran death squads, the notorious Salvadoran death squads in 1980, tortured and raped because she was simply speaking out against this really cruel government down there. And it was my first venture into kind of feature-length documentary, and I think not only Maria's story, but Walter's story here in The Thick Dark Fog, it's kind of this extension of my acting work. I think it's, you know, as actors, you're taught to know your character's motivation, do your research on a historical figure, if you're playing a historical, or anybody, to be thorough, you know, this method kind of thing. And so that's how I was trained by a lot of New York stage actors and the Actors Studio, Neighborhood Playhouse training. And And I'd, alongside of that, I'd always liked documentaries that focused on the, an individual's struggle or journey. And I kind of combined my work as an actor with my love of documentaries. And I just, I met this woman, Maria, and she wanted to tell her story. I wanted to help her tell it, and I did. And I finished it in 2001, and it really touched a nerve, particularly in the Salvadoran American community here in the States, L.A., San Francisco, Washington, up in Vancouver, where there are a lot of large populations who could relate to Maria's story, who identified, who it's hard to meet a Salvadoran here in this country who have not been touched by the death squads and the effect that civil war had on the families there. So many, over 80,000 were disappeared, they say, probably more. Close to, you know, it might be able to be called a genocide down there. And the same, you know, the psychological journey, and the same thing happened here with Walter when I came upon his story. And I, you know, it's hard to talk about Walter's film without talking about Maria's film, these overcoming attacks on ethnic identity. So there's a personal tie-in with me. You know, I see these people as unapologetic, in Maria's case, the leftist, formerly, you know, Marxist from that part of the world, but unapologetic about the strength of her identity as a Latina woman, as, you know, plainly an indigenous woman. Pipil is the tribes down there in Central America. And also with Walter, who is unapologetically tied to his identity and proud and wants to let people know about it. But in these two folks' stories, they've been suppressed for whatever reasons. And I just felt that it was important for me in my journey in life to help them get their voices heard and probably in a self-serving kind of way, strengthening my identity, which has been very important to me and been wrestling with that good part of my life. And I don't know, does that answer the question?
No, that was pretty good. I tell you, what struck me in what you said and what stays in my mind right now is that you became an actor to find your identity. You came into acting to find out who you are, where mostly you hear actors say, we came in to act to expand ourselves, to be something else other than what we are. You seem to come in for the opposite reason, and in doing so, you've landed some pretty good roles. You were in Level 7, Perceptions, JAG, First Monday, The Love Boat, The Next Wave, Moonbase, The Stranger, Acapulco. I mean, the list goes on and on. And in doing these films, and I'm looking at the dates of your appearances, you were actually already doing this documentary while you were still doing appearances on TV, correct?
Yeah. What happened was in the late 90s, I'd been at it for about 18 years as an actor, and finally I kind of hit it. As we say here, my number came up, and I was just started working a lot in episodic television, one-hour dramas. I was a regular in about three television series in a row within three, four years. Mm-hmm. And I was making all this money, and that's when I was also meeting Maria and making her film. So I just self-financed that. I didn't wait around for any granters or any. I didn't apply for any grant. Just kind of followed through with my vision. With my editor, Paul Friedman, helped me, kind of mentored me through the process, and we made the film after 4 years. And I started off with Walter's film, The Thick Dark Fog, self-financing it. To the tune, after 7 years, I spent about $55,000 of my own money. And then I got a grant a year ago from Native American Public Telecommunications, which is responsible for the Native content on PBS, right? And that really sped up the process of getting the film done, along with my producer, Jonathan Skernick, who is a very seasoned producer, filmmaker, and he's had things on PBS, so he really helped me shepherd the film to its completion. And So, yeah, I mean, making films is a very expensive undertaking, but fortunately for me, I was able to have some of my own seed money to really get these Walter's story going and Maria's, and I'm very thankful for that, to have met these people, and, you know, being persistent, like my father. I think I got a lot of traits of my father and my mother that really helped me deal with Hollywood in a kind of a healthy way, you know, without succumbing to addictions and what a lot of my friends happened to a lot of my friends, because you get a lot of time, you have a lot of time on your hands, and sometimes that's not good for certain people. But I think the strength of my family support really helped me, and that I have to credit them with the completion of these films too. They've been very supportive. Yeah.
Well, that, you said you got into acting back in the 80s. Defend yourself. Let me ask you, 2011. Randy, have you found yourself?
Oh, man, I'm so far ahead. I'm so happy of what I found so far. You know, still living, still searching, as we all are.
Sure.
When I got to Hollywood in 1979, I was so far away from who I felt I was that I used my mother's maiden name as my stage name, Randy Galleon, because I just couldn't identify with Vasquez and Mexico and my roots. And that happened for about 7 or 8 years until I guess I woke up one day and I said, you know, I can't live this lie anymore. I have to accept myself. After a lot of conversations, some therapy, you know, helped me lead me to that decision. And I took about a month-long trip into Mexico, deep into Mexico, to Mexico City. And there was a writer's strike in Hollywood, so there was no work. So it was a good time to take off. And I just kind of, without any itinerary, I went down there for about a month and just traveled by train, by bus, met people. I remember when I took a bus into Mexico City for the first time and I saw all these brown people, I just felt like I was at home. I felt something inside me felt like I had arrived and that it was okay to be who I was. So that was the as far as my self-acceptance, this kind of Mecca thing trip I took into Mexico was a defining time in my life. I think it was 27 or 28. And then doing Maria's film was, again, embracing that part of myself, that Latino part of myself, by profiling this really strong Latino woman, who I think in some ways might have reminded me of my grandmother, my Mexican grandmother, who was a very strong woman who I loved very much and who only spoke Spanish, and but who we were still able to communicate with each other. And so that's kind of how that went. And Walter, when I met Walter, he was, you know, I had an affinity for him also. And I just decided I'm in this full on. You know, both Walter and Maria wanted their stories out there, but they were having a hard time doing it. And so I said, look, you know, we agreed to make a film. We, both of us, both in both cases, we collaborated. You know, I showed Walter Maria's film. I said, listen, if you want your story to be told, because he was trying to get his memoir published and he was having problems. Take a look at this documentary on Maria Guardado. If you'd like to collaborate on a documentary about your story, let me know. So they called me, him and his wife called me back 2 weeks later and said, yeah, let's do it. So that was 7 years ago. And it's gone through a lot of phases, up and down and all around. But it finally, you know, I was gonna profile four Native people around the country, Alaska, Michigan, South Dakota, and Arizona, to kind of show the national scope of the boarding school policy. But that all kind of caved in a couple of years ago under the weight of its own ambition. People kind of dropped out, decided they didn't want to be a part of the film. So I had to reconfigure everything. I said, let me just go back to my original participant, Walter, and tell his story as best I can. And mm-hmm. That's how that turned out.
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell you, talking about Maria, I did watch some stuff on YouTube. She's full on YouTube, so you folks out there, check her out. It's Maria, last name, Guardado.
Yeah.
Check out Maria Guardado on YouTube. And I'm going to tell you, she's got an amazing story. She didn't just blame the Civil War that was backed by the U.S. in her country. She pointed the finger at the CIA.
Yeah, specifically. Well, you know, I mean, it's no secret now that the CIA was very involved and our government was very involved. And during that time when the Cold War was really at its height, or very still going strong, you know, it was a few years after Vietnam, I think, the country was looking for some kind of show of strength and some sort of reaction to that, the dreadful end of the Vietnam War. And they were... This thing was being perpetuated that the Russians were going to invade us, right, from our back door through Central America and Mexico, and that any kind of any hint of communism, socialism had to be snuffed out. And so the death squads were just kidnapping anybody on the streets,
right,
just to put fear into the public that you better not say anything against us, or, you know, we're not going to tolerate anything. And but Maria and a lot of people didn't care. They would speak out anyway, and sure enough, she was kidnapped on a street corner right in front of an ice cream parlor. She'd gotten an ice cream, and these guys in a car came, rolled up and grabbed her, threw in the car. She was held for 3 days, tortured, raped, wanted names of her associates. She wouldn't give up any names. She was prepared to die. But somehow, you know, they threw her out of a running car, left her for dead in the street, and she, some of her friends got her out of the country. There was a thing called a sanctuary movement in the 80s, which was church run by churches in Canada and the United States. It was helping a lot of those Civil War refugees from Central America get out of there and come to Canada and the United States, and that's who helped Maria eventually.
Well, she definitely is a strong voice in any of the political activism that's going on today in Los Angeles. She's well known, and her voice is heard. People do stop and listen when it's Maria. So if you haven't heard her story, you haven't seen it, definitely get into YouTube to check it out, and get Nell to put some links in the chat room for our viewers in the chat room also. With that, I want to open up the panel. We have David Little Eagle joining us today, and also Nell Cole, our producer. So I'd like to open up the panel and see if they have any questions at this point before we get into our topic today, which is the Fifth Dark Fog.
Go ahead, David.
So, David.
Okay, thank you, Mel. My mind was kind of flashing back as I was listening to Randy speaking of this strong indigenous woman, Maria Guanzalo. 3 years after she had been kidnapped and brutalized by the Salvadoran death squads. I was working as a peace officer status security officer in New York City, and I was working in an abandoned, well, not abandoned, but they were trying, it was a medical facility that, well, for all intents and purposes, was abandoned, and I was guarding narcotics, medical narcotics, pharmaceuticals, in a drug-infested neighborhood. And as I was working there, I was listening to a tape by an activist, musician, and songwriter named Ruben Blades. I don't know if you remember him. Ruben Blades had written many songs on the horrors that happen in places like Salvador and other places in Guatemala and other places terrorized over there. And one song that he sang in particular, he wrote and sang, was Blood on the Moon, the concept was Blood on the Moon, speaking about the abductions, the tortures, the executions. And early on, I had worked for the United Methodist Committee on Relief, and I saw pictures. I had was reviewing dossiers about, you know, regarding the victims of terrorism, governmental terrorism in other countries. And I have to tell you that witnessing these things, experiencing these people, I had never met them, but I saw their dossiers. I saw photographs of the victims of these abductions and tortures. And I will tell you right now, my mind was flashing back as I was listening to Randy speak, and I could, you know, just feel the tears in my eyes just welling up, just remembering the horrors that these precious people experience. I have a great deal of respect for you, Randy, for what you're doing for the people whose voice needs to be heard.
Yeah.
I personally thank you so much. You know, governmental terrorism is wrong. No matter who perpetrates it, it's always wrong.
Yeah.
And my prayers and my gratitude go up for you, Randy. I really, really appreciate you, brother. Thank you for what you're doing.
Oh, David. You're welcome, David. Thank you. It's it's an effortless endeavor. I mean, it's tough making films, but I guess I really love Maria and Walter. I love what they stand for. I believe what they stand for is important. I believe that their stories are necessary. They've been shut down too long. And I think that their stories, their realities can help make this country a better place at a time when it really needs to be a better place. It always needs to be a better place, I should say. But, you know, I think that as far as the board, you know, my opinion, the boarding school issue is, the time is finally kind of coming. You know, I'm certainly not the first documentary on the boarding schools, especially from Canada. You know, they've been, it seems like the last 20 years, the top has been lifted off this kind of Pandora's box.
Yep.
Of nightmares, and slowly, it's not going to be up to me. It's going to be up to the people. Like Walter was finally, you know, 10, 12 years ago, he finally decided, I need to get this story out about what happened to me, the shame. You know, I held on to it for almost 60 years. It's time to get rid of it. It's time to let the world know about it. It's time to reach out to my children who I'm estranged from and explain to them why I was the way I was and why now we have no relationship, because it's really tough for me to call up my kids and, you know, tell them I love them or something like that, but maybe I can do it through this book. So it's a movement, I think, maybe within Native people that they're starting to somehow find the strength to talk about what happened to them at these schools. And that's what Walter's message is to, you know, if I can do it, you can do it. And if you need help, get in contact with me, and I'll try and talk you through it the best I can. This is the way I did it. It's not for everybody. You know, we all have to find our road to recovery. And this is my way. And what I did was I just simply, you know, I'd seen a lot of documentaries on boarding schools, and they're very good, and they're all very important because they're recorded. But what I wanted to add was a kind of a cinematic element, and instead of just a bunch of kind of talking heads and kind of a pedantic kind of a lecture thing about, I wanted to use the tools of cinema, music, flashbacks, recreations, whatever else I used, cinematography, you know, sound effects, to get this story out there and make it somehow make it entertaining. Because you don't want to bore people, you want to get the message, make it an artful experience, I suppose. So.
Well, I tell you, Randy, by your generosity and your co-producer John Stenick, his generosity, you did allow us to view the film in its entirety, and I'm going to tell you, it's a very powerful documentary. There is not one boring part in it. It seems to encircle the whole element of healing. And I believe when Walter did state in the film that he was going to, he needed to explain himself. He needed to explain to his children why he was that way, and you brought that up, and I'm glad you did, because that was another important part in the movie to me. Walter has a need to explain his actions.
Yeah.
What he's done in his life, and although, as a Native myself, I respect that man, and that man has no explanation to tell us why the things he's done. But it has nothing to do with us. It has to do with Walter having to get this out of him. and
yeah.
learning to appreciate what life he has left. And there was a beautiful
That's
story.
Right. Yeah.
It was full circled. It definitely has a little, you got to watch for things in that film, because I'm going to tell you, he does got some things in there that that actually will, if you follow him, will you will follow the circle. You will see how it comes full force. And
yeah.
I can only imagine that this has helped Walter heal. It is intergenerational, and Walter sees that, and Walter has the need to explain to his children why he was that way. It's the beginning. It's the start, and you're right. In the last 20 years, the lid has come off the Pandora box, and it's time to tell it, as horrific as it is, because it does get pretty horrific from each survivor story until we get to the next. So they do have to be told, you know, and it has to be told in this light. It can't be told in the way of like a TRC in Canada where it's controlled and you can't name names and they tell you what you can say. You need to let the truth flow freely.
Yeah.
And that's what you've done in this work, and it's just amazing.
Well, good. I think that, you know, I read a lot of on the internet about stories and the testimonials that are going up in Canada and here even. And, I mean, it's, you know, I think when I was doing the film, you know, I wanted to make it, you know, which was impossible. I wanted to make it the definitive boarding school documentary, which is impossible because there's thousands of stories. And I've always said that to do right by a documentary on the schools, it's got to be a mini series going over at least two nights, you know, 2 hours each night, and then maybe you'll get you'll understand what the boarding school experience was. You'll get a real taste of it, because, and I have to bring this up, is that the boarding schools and a lot of folks, that Native people that went there, it saved their lives. It was, in fact, a positive experience without a lot of the abuse, and those stories must be told too, I think. But having said that, it doesn't justify some of these horror stories. That needs to be told, and healing happens, and then to move on. Instead, like Chris Eaglehawk told me in an interview, it didn't make it into the film, but he said, "We're tired of surviving. We just want to live. You know, we've been surviving for so long. It takes so much effort and energy." So, we'll see. Maybe, you know, some other ones will come out. Theatrical pieces, films, you know, an American version of a rabbit-proof fence. The story from Australia from 2004 is exact. I mean, it's almost like you can just fit Walter's story right in there. It'll fit right in. I mean, we need to have a commercial and artistic success like that, so the mainstream can see. It's tough because there's a lot of Native people here in Hollywood. They're trying to, you know, make their voices heard, find a foothold in television and film, and it's simply not easy. The tradition, there's not a long tradition of
right
storytelling. From a Native
point of view.
Yeah.
I like the idea that you brought up, that there has to be a balance in telling of the story. And you're absolutely right. There has to be a balance. There are success stories that came out of these residential schools, but not success as we measure it today. I'm talking about success that they survived. That was very successful.
Mm-hmm.
Another success is that a lot of these survivors also believe that there was a curriculum. And there were people who did excel, and these simply happened to be people who would turn in the children who still spoke their language and things like that. So there's a lot of that animosity going on, too. So you're absolutely fair and balanced in telling it. And I'm going to tell you, it does show through in your documentary, and people are going to see that when that film comes out in 2012. There's another element, too. There has to be, you know, there's all kinds of realms of healing, Randy, and one of them has to be a justice. I mean, when do we, and maybe not a justice so much as that someone goes on trial and goes to jail, but a justice to where there's an understanding in a society that we no longer do this. It doesn't seem to have been produced in society itself, and it seems like the generation that happened on this continent for seven generations continues around the world today because we don't address the beginning of it, and that is the justice that happened here under Lila.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
oh, gosh.
There has to be a balance. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and, you know, film and video, it's a powerful medium, and it's definitely a way to, you know, versus books, it's a way to get it out there. And there's definitely Native filmmakers out there that are struggling and getting their work out there, and I think there's something brewing here. I think there's the Native cinematic movement is on the rise, and it's there's a lot of intelligence involved in it, and so I think that there's going to be some more through the medium. It's going to help what you just said, I think.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely right. You have to bring it. It has to be brought forth in a professional way through the media. People,
yeah.
You know, without getting into the problems of society, you know, people tend to believe what they read. You have to show them the documented proof. And when you do things like that, you're basically doing that. And that's what people thrive on. Word of mouth don't get it. You have to show it to me, you know. And that's the
yeah.
society that we've become over time. We've evolved. But this documentary certainly is an eye-opener. And I certainly hope and put prayer into your vision that this
well,
is going to blow up again. And that we're going to see a lot more of this type of a perception. Because
yeah.
the truth
yeah.
is
yeah.
what will change the future. You know?
Well, I think I just want to add there's a moment in the film where there's a strong emotional moment in the film where I was interviewing Walter, and he has this emotional kind of moment, strong emotional moment.
Yeah.
And I decided to put that in because I think it in a symbolic way, it kind of represents what, you know, what you got to go through to get to the other side, to walk in the light. You have to go through this darkness and meet the enemy.
Yeah.
I've met the enemy, and it is myself, and it is within me.
Yeah.
And he, you know, you got to cross that river, and it's not easy. You got to admit to some things first. And that's kind of what that moment is about, and it represents what, in small part, what Walter went through in those 4 years that it took him to write his memoirs and to get through the boarding school stuff. So I felt that was what was important, because if you hang on to those feelings, that's when you get into some real trouble, the suicide rates and whatnot, if you don't deal with it.
Randy, can you speak about his wife as well? Because without her, I think that the story wouldn't have happened.
Yeah. What happened was after Wounded Knee in 73, Walter, you know, a resident, lifelong resident, and he lived right across the highway from the church. And, you know, of course, the American Indian Movement looted his house, took all the wood, took it apart for bunkers, and stole a lot of family personal belongings. And like he says in the film, it really destroyed the community of Wounded Knee. Any kind of cohesiveness, any kind of neighborly community, sense of community that it had, it really destroyed it for many years after. And so Walter took it upon himself to do something about that. He went to move to Denver, and he started this nonprofit to gather goods, appliances, and he would chuck them out to a Wounded Knee for the winter, you know. And that became he got some public public attention for that, the national media and local media. And this woman, Jane, his future wife, Jane Ridgway, lived in a non-Indian, lived in, you know, a well-to-do community in Connecticut, and she came upon this magazine that had an article about him and that he was asking for donations and had his number in the magazine. She called it up. She'd been interested in Indians, American Indians, and called him up, invited him out and his partner out to Connecticut to talk at the local library about what was going on in Wounded Knee and what was going on in that particular reservation. And they were both married at the time to different people. They had families, and But Jane, they developed this relationship, kind of a business relationship, a supportive relationship, and trying to get the word out about life on reservations. So fast forward about 10, 12 years later, they both found themselves single again. But they were still friends and in contact, and Walter invited Jane to live, to come to Wounded Knee. If you really want to be involved like you say you do, you know, come out here. If you like it, you can stay. Maybe we can work something out between us. And sure enough, she did. And they ended up getting married, and she really... There would be no book, there would be no film without her, you know,
exactly.
Without him either. I mean, it's, you know, she was able to help him get through those memories. You know, they went to the VA hospital. The doctor said, you know, you just got to talk through it. It's the only way through it is through it. The doctor told Jane, don't take any of it personal. There's going to be a lot of emotions. Let it slide off your back as much as you can. It's not about you. So, and that's how they battled that demon, and it's been a real mature, it's been a real, you know, relationship. How should I call it? I can't find the words, but they've done a lot together.
Only a wife knows what it takes to help her husband when that dark fog comes. And she's the only one that truly knows how dark it gets.
Yeah.
And how hard she had to pull to get him back out of it. Because it's a very hard road when you've got memories.
I know that Walter appreciates that. And I know that he completely acknowledges her role in all this. Without her, you know.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have gotten
it definitely shows.
Yeah. Go ahead.
It definitely shows throughout the film. She is she's the foundation to Walter.
Yeah.
She kind of took this man who wanted help, who she saw needed help, because that's how I view her. She saw he needed this, and that's where that connection of friendship came, and then eventually blossomed into a marriage. But it without her writing down everything that came out of him, not understanding what he was saying or how it played. And then later, after 4 years or 5 years of doing this, then piecing it all together, I mean, she was an instrumental role in helping Walter begin his healing process. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think she's healed, too. I think being with Walter has helped her, too, has healed her in probably ways that aren't too obvious. I think she would say that. I think her life has been very enriched by this change. So it's definitely they're balancing off each other. And through her life living there on the reservation with Walter, she's been able to share that with her family and friends across the country. And so there's definitely a rippling effect of awareness building, education, enlightenment to the non-Native community. So.
Go ahead, Russ.
No, go ahead.
It's important that there is outside allies to help get the message out. Because, I mean, on Pine Ridge, they know their truth. But it's important that we carry it as well within our communities and try to work together to bring quality of life to them, like Russ does with what he does with Whispering Thunder, bringing propane and different things to it. It's all a collective effort.
Yeah,
that's right.
You know, the Native Nations, the people who truly are following their spirituality and their traditions and customs know it takes all of us. There's four races. We're all here. It takes us. There is no going home. We're here. Now what we need to do is learn to live together and learn to respect each other and honor the two-world wampum and simply live in equality.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we don't live in societies like that. We're ruled by corporation and our laws are brokered by them. So, I mean, we're not here to make the world a better. We're not here to fix all the world's problems, but what we certainly can do is help people begin to realize that they need to get it out and begin this healing process. We are our own solutions once we become strong.
So once we become strong, we become our own solution, and we don't have to wait on anyone to come do it for us. But thank God, what we got to do first is get into our nations, and we got to start healing people.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, I don't know, I'm not sure, maybe you guys would know more about this than I do, but maybe this word healing has certain connotations of weakness to a lot of people, and this kind of Oprah, kind of New Age thing, feel-good kind of endeavor. And I think that healing is not, it's a pretty word, yeah, it's a nice word, but there's what's involved in healing is often dark and ugly and tough. You got to be tough. There's no weakness about it. So, I don't know, that's just a thought I've been thinking about since I've been working. This word healing is thrown around a lot, and you know, I think people have different interpretations of it, but I think it's probably the best word. It gets right to it.
I'm actually glad you brought that up, because you're absolutely right. That word is thrown around like, you know, all you got to do is heal and everything's going to be okay, and it's hunky-dory.
Yeah.
The roses are going to come up in the springtime. Healing to me is more or less coming back to your spirituality. You cannot heal without it. You need to get back to what you believe in, whether it be God and Jesus, or whether it be, you know, your own ancestral beliefs, or, you know, if your religion tells you to lick a rock, like I've said many times, then by all means lick that damn rock. If you choose to honor God, you know, just bring Christmas back into the heart of people all year long. You know, what happens with compassion and caring, and that's what healing is to me. Healing is getting to a point in your life where you know what you've been through, but you don't live there no more, and you have the rest of it to look forward to. That to me.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that's living in the light. That's really a light, joyous feeling that you have. You know, and when you're taken away at 5 years old and you're beaten and people are yelling at you and that you're living in an atmosphere of tension and stress, and you're witnessing your friends getting beaten and crying and suffering, and you know, it comes down to, you know, parenting or lack thereof, how one is judged and looked at, and the character. And you know, if you have strong parents, strong family ties, you can certainly accomplish a lot more. And I think that, you know, you look at the privileged class, and those are the ones that are succeeding, or those are the ones that are being celebrated and glorified in a sense. And, you know, it's not just Indians, but, you know, poor people in general, the poor class, they're just, it's a tough road. And, you know, there are stories there, is I guess what I'm trying to say, the stories of struggle and survival. There's another kind of cliche word, but, you know, these are rich stories as opposed to, these stories of privilege that, you know, we see on TV all the time. And yes, we have, and culture is assimilating us towards that success story, but it leaves people yearning without having the tools to get there, without having the opportunities. And you can be like this, but I don't know, it's difficult for people. And I see it. I see the young people trying to be something they're not in order to fit in, or they see, you know, all the technology and everything, and there's a tradition that is being lost, and I think that's what Walter represents, for sure.
For sure.
I think that's what Maria represents in a sense as well.
Yeah.
So it's a struggle to stay true to your roots, kind of, without losing them, without losing that language, because language isn't so important. It comes down to language in so many ways when you talk about the native issues, you guys know. I don't have to, something you already know. But I just think it's a beautiful thing. I mean, I went back with the success I had on TV. You know, I made some real estate purchases when, you know, at the right time, and I was able to finance. I got to UCLA in 79. I came up after I graduated high school in San Diego, and I'd been going to UCLA to try and get into theater, to try and get into acting. I couldn't get into it, so I dropped out, and I made my connections, and na-na-na-na. But 2-3 years ago, I had enough money, now I decided to go back to UCLA and go into the American Indian Studies program, from which I graduated this past June, which was basically to supplement this film and my knowledge of Native realities. You know, I can only get so much in school and through books, but it's really, I was on that track already, but now it's been a real good thing. Plus, I wanted my, you know, I was the last person in my family to graduate college, and it was really important for me that my parents see me graduate after all these years. I just think it's there's so much there that this country doesn't know about that can, I mean, it's just outrageous. I mean, the literature, the art, the spirituality, the, name something else, I don't know, the laws.
Right.
Traditional tribal law, all kinds
of
things.
All of our history.
All of the history.
You know, a lot of the things known today in society, you know, the laws, the structure of it, you know, the religion that has replaced the spirituality, it all comes from tribal. They seem to reach in and grab bits and pieces that are familiar, and then what they did was they molded it into a religion. And in this ball of religion, they turned it upside down. And it has been in that upside down balance that we linger in today.
Yeah.
And we have replaced our spirituality with what we believe to be a religion. And we're just following a completely wrong concept of who we are as a people. And through assimilation and, you know, and evolution and progress and everything else, there's just so hard to believe what's true and what's not anymore. You know, once your eyes are open, it's really hard to close them again.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you can't go back to believing everything is hunky-dory. Your eyes have been open now. And now that they're open, you put yourself to be a minority once again, you know? Mm-hmm. And you connect with people like yourself, Randy, and other networks around the world and with people like Kevin Annett and his networks and fighting for justice. And I mean, it's the whole ramit and gamut of it all that has to come together if we ever plan to bring a change in the future.
Yeah.
Because if we're not planning on bringing a change, then it's really a waste of time.
Yeah,
you know?
I agree.
So it is about educating and bringing a change, absolutely.
Yeah.
Hey, Randy.
Yes, ma'am.
One, what documentary do you have in your mind that you'd love to make now? Do you have anything that's got you sparked now?
No, I don't. I don't. I finished Maria's film in 2001, and it took me 3 years to start on another one. And I'm open, but... And people come with me with suggestions and stuff, but I found that it's got to come from me in order for me to invest I'm going to invest
a,
and get my team together and sell it to my team.
Right.
But I look forward to it.
It's a labor of love, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I definitely have a few seeds that I want to throw into the soil.
Okay.
Me too.
You know, we definitely got to look into the stealing of Native children that still happens today in 2001.
Right.
We have more children, more Native children, more brown-skinned children in state custody today than we did the whole 110 years of residential schools. Once again, these are more children. This is modern genocide. We're stealing them away from their communities, away from their traditions, their language, their customs, and we're also stealing away their status, a status that, through treaties, these children must be paid to their nation. So when you steal these children and they're sold for profit to non-Native families, these children lose that status, once again keeping the numbers of Native population to a standstill for over 100 years.
Right.
It continues. It's just changed its method. It still has the same head. It hasn't died. It's just changed its methods.
And I read an article the other day about the sanitariums that the Indian children were taken to.
Oh, yeah, those asylums.
And experimented on, sterilized, and just maltreated.
Oh, yeah.
And there are survivor stories from that, too.
Yes.
Yeah, there definitely is. But what I found, because I've been carrying this message pretty about the schools pretty heavy for the past 3 years, mm-hmm. and what it's done is I've expanded it to Australia and Canada and Ireland.
Yeah.
And these
mm-hmm.
schools were all existing there in their own version of it. So
right.
as you begin to expand the network, you begin to realize that this was not just isolated things, that they did this to children around the world. And I've been lucky enough to have these children now in my network, and their stories are so similar that besides the color of their skin, you can't tell a bit of difference between them. Actually, even in the chat room right now, there's someone from Australia
who oh, wow.
lived that. So
yeah.
the listeners have lived this all around the world.
And the real shame now is that, and you know as well as I do, doing these shows along with you for the last year and a half, is that it's happening today. It's not like it's
Absolutely.
Done.
Yeah.
And we can go back and clean it up in our own leisure. The longer we take to clean it up, the longer it continues to happen. It's happening today in Asia. It's happening in the Middle East with these missionaries, and it's happening in Africa. What we've experienced over generations is being produced today. So in 100 years
right.
from now, we're going to hear a lot more apologies. But they're going to be apologies of things that are happening today that we have not yet addressed
exactly.
because we're trying to get the, from the past addressed. You know, so it's not like it ended. It's continuing. It's just a different region, and it's different children now.
Yeah, yeah, I have a link on the Thick Dark Fog website, and I found it a few years ago, and I think it's boardingschool.org or boardingschoolsurvivor.org, and it's an organization out of England, which is where the fine tradition of boarding schools began many centuries ago. In an effort to kind of prepare children for, you know, the construction of empire, to make England a strong country, to separate them from their parents, to make them strong, disciplined
right.
individuals, to take over the world. And so, you know, the British, yeah, they brought the system here. They brought it to Canada. They brought it to Australia, New Zealand
right.
maybe, India, Ireland.
Yeah.
So it began in England, and there's organizations in England, boarding school healing organizations that as former students are trying to heal from their experience.
Right.
I mean, I was watching a documentary.
They ship children all around the world.
Yeah, yeah. It's a documentary about Joe Strummer, the former, the late guitarist for the rock band The Clash, very popular in the 70s and 80s, and he went to a boarding school in England, and he described how horrific it was, how one of his
yep.
One of his classmates hung himself, and it's just, you know, I suppose there are some positive stories, but you know, it's just what good can be of separating
right.
from your family
right.
yeah,
yeah, even if there are positive stories, when you have a law that targets a certain group, then
yeah.
anything good
yeah.
that comes out of it is just purely accidental.
You know,
because,
and I have a really...
Yeah.
Go ahead now.
Go ahead.
You make
ahead.
A very good point. You're absolutely right, and it goes into what I was going to say, is that it's really hard for me to distinguish that a mind that can actually put the fingers of a child into a desk and slam the lid on the frail, fragile fingers
right.
of a child. Could be gentle to the next one.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? That's psychological thriller shit. And I just
mm-hmm.
don't get where we do hear, and we hear it from survivors. I never saw that. It didn't happen to me. But what was the light switch that turned on and off in these monsters' minds that was able to do it to one child but not the next? I just don't get that part.
Everything seems to be financially based, so it could have been the poorer the children, the higher the target, because the less profit, so the less quality of education you got.
Yeah.
I think it's misuse of power on a lot of levels.
Yeah.
I think if you have a lowly matron or teacher out in the middle of nowhere on a reservation in a boarding school,
right.
probably thinks you can get away with anything they want. They can take out their own frustrations. Like you kick a dog, like you
yeah.
take your anger out on your wife or your husband or your
mm-hmm.
kids. You just, you dumb kid, just smack them. No, you can get away with it. you know, abuse of power kind of means that abuse of power means, well, I can abuse my power because I know I won't get caught and nobody will do anything to me. Look at the Penn State thing, you know. It's just a bunch of guys. It's kind of a old guys club, you know, kind of turn your head and that didn't happen. He didn't rape that child. It'll go away. He won't do it again. He'll realize he's wrong. You know, if you can get away with it, then people are going to keep doing it.
And the structure itself honors sociopaths. It promotes sociopaths.
Mm-hmm.
So, because you're trying to break the spirit and community of a child.
Yeah.
Walter himself even says in the documentary that in his first marriage, you know, he has the need to explain to his children why he's the way he is. And he says in the documentary that he was he disciplined. That's what he knew to do. It's what he was taught.
Right. Yeah.
He knew to discipline.
Yeah.
You know, and I can only imagine the hurt in a heart once you've now realized that, you know, I now need to make amends. And make amends for something that you survived from. I mean, it's a vicious circle. It should have never happened. The shame is it continues to happen today because we keep putting money into churches that continue to produce these types of practices. You know?
Yeah.
I would love for people to understand the connectiveness of all of this. If I ever was going to do a documentary, I would definitely do it on that because these survivors are right here beside us. It's not a historical documentation of it. They're right here listening to the show right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love for people to understand that these are really people right beside you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... I appreciate the dialogue. I mean, it's just that's where it starts. If more people could talk about the boarding school experience from all angles, and it'll encourage those. I mean, you just build one block on top of another. People who are never thought that they could speak about it will maybe be encouraged to pick up the phone or talk to somebody or write a letter and say, "This is what happened to me." But it's, you know, it's got to be, it's easier for some people to admit to that than others. If so, it can be dangerous, I understand, for certain traumas.
Right.
Because you can kind of be put back in that moment. And that's, I think if you don't have a professional person present, you know, there might be some damage done there. People who are forced to take the stand in a trial about child abuse, soon after they'll commit suicide because they couldn't deal with being publicly publicly outed for what happened to them. I mean, this is real. That's another element.
Huge element of it.
Yeah. So, that was when I was talking to these people about their memories, particularly Walter, and I just felt like sometimes I was on the very edge of taking this man back to a place that I didn't. I was very respectful of that edge, and I was very nervous about it, and, you know, Jane was there off camera kind of refereeing the situation. You know, he can only take so much, don't ask him that, he can, you know, because in truth, it was like, yeah, I can answer him, and I can get great footage and powerful moments, but then I leave and I come back home. She's got to deal with that fallout.
Exactly.
Days after and the months after, where that just talking about it gets them so down and depressed and dark for weeks, months. I don't have to deal with that anymore. She does.
Right.
Exactly.
So that was some of the terrain that I had to be respectful, but, you know, I was a filmmaker trying to tell the story.
Right.
And I really hated it. There were times when I was so stressed out that I... But Walter was giving. He wanted it too, so it was just a strange dynamic going on.
Right. Yeah. We've had our survivors on, and it is a delicate balance. I've had them cry, and it's breaking my heart because I want to just shelter them. But then I want their truth to be known, and I want people to understand it is dark. It is ugly. That's what we created in these children's life. And you can't do that by sugarcoating or pulling back. But then there is that element of you don't want to leave anybody harmed at the end. But I found them having their voice is healing in itself.
Yeah.
And being able to truly speak from their heart on things that most people are like, oh, that's too much, and somebody actually wants to hear the ugly details of it, that piece has value to them.
Yeah.
I tell you, I'm a very strong person, and I know that my brother David there is too, but I tell you, on this subject, when I start hearing these stories and then those tears start coming, I become a big bumbling idiot.
Yeah.
It affects my heart, and it crushes my spirit to know what has happened to my ancestry. It angers me to know that there is still no healing, and whatever healing there is, it's coming out of the same churches who produced these atrocities, and they want you to sit with the perpetrators to do this healing.
Yeah.
You know, it angers me enough to where the first thing that comes to my heart is revenge. And I have to pray that away, because I tell you, I want to go get my pitchfork and I want to get my torch and I want to burn them to the ground. You know, it is a very horrific place to be in, just hearing them explain what they've been through. And I tell you, there's a need to hear their words.
Yeah.
And then you have to control yourself, because I tell you, as a compassionate human being, my first thought is revenge, and then
that's something that Walter expressed to me. It's not in the film, but as a younger man, he remembers just seeing the next white, he'd see a white person. Just the thought was just to go scalp a person. Just his first reaction, just to destroy any white folks that he saw.
Right.
Just that trigger anger, just very strong. Right.
I've run across that dealing with this issue and being white. I've definitely run across that. But I've run across the other that's just as compassionate toward me and thankful for what I'm doing. But it definitely is a danger when you're white and discussing this issue.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's definitely something that you need to keep in mind.
Yeah.
There's a lot of anger and I think you hit it on the head, Randy, when you said that, you got to be delicate. You have to know what you're doing, and there has to be professionals involved. And it's a dark thing that's been hidden from history.
Mm-hmm.
And as it continues to be unfolded, it's ugly. It's going to be ugly. It's going to get worse. And we need to be ready for it. It's coming.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. Hopefully soon, but it'll be on its own time.
Right.
In a sense.
David, is there anything you wanted to add at this point?
Well, I was thinking about the process of healing that we were talking about before, and how, how Randy had to kind of exercise the very difficult task of getting the information, getting the story told, and considering the potential consequence of the truth being told on the part of the teller. And, when we asked what healing was, and we were pondering the question, what is it? What is healing? Is it some new age thing like Russ was saying before? There are some people out there who say, I'm going to put a chicken feather on your head and that's more, and everything's going to be fine. Healing is a process, I think about the time when I broke my hand. I'm a musician, and I play piano, I play flute, and needless to say, when I broke my hand, I could not play, and after surgery, I had to undergo painful physical therapy, and I saw many other patients undergoing painful physical therapy, after surgery, after trauma, after severe injuries or sickness, and the healing, and like Randy was saying before, you got to be tough, and you have to be able to endure that therapy in order to achieve that level of healing, and I'm grateful for the fact that in the case of these two extraordinary people, that Randy is instrumental in beginning that healing process, because as long as the torment is kept in, sure, there'll be weeks of darkness, weeks of depression, or perhaps even outbursts of anger, But, you know, it's like popping an abscess. It's like popping an infection.
Yeah.
It's going to hurt like hell. But the process needs to be done. That boil has to be lanced for the poisons to get out. Because as long as we keep them in, it's going to shorten our lives. So I'm very grateful for the fact that indigenous peoples worldwide have the chance to see this, to see these extraordinary documentaries, and it's going to begin that healing process. Now, what I ask for, and I ask the great mystery for all the time, is healing for the minds of the perpetrators as well, because they're still out there, and they hide behind the shadows of their perpetrations. But, you know, I really, really seek healing for their hearts and minds because they are so sick and so corrupted. So it the sickness is on both sides of the spectrum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's deep. That's to come to that place to replace the hatred with forgiveness. If not forgiveness, but just looking towards being able to forgive, the journey to be aware of forgiveness. It's. I don't think I've been able to do that in a lot of ways, but. There's a lot of strength in being able to do that, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
But justice is also necessary, I think, for a lot of people, too, for healing. And even admittance, you know, there's this apology to Native peoples by Obama last year, a year before, you know, it was kind of buried in some subcommittee, but you know, not a lot of people. It was not really open to a lot of conversation. I mean,
right.
You know, it didn't make the headlines of the New York Times or anything. And that's there's so many, 300 million people in this country. You gotta find a way to catch their ears with all the noise in the world going on, just grabbing the headlines and the attention. You know, how do you get your headlines up there?
Well, they're professional apologizers, I guess.
Yeah.
Around the world, but unless it's attached to some type of action that brings change,
yeah.
It's really just empty words.
Mm.
You know,
yeah.
They want to write a check and say, let's move on, but that check doesn't help that person in the middle of the night when they're having flashbacks or their family is destroyed or, you know, completely torn apart because you don't know how to say I love you.
Yeah.
A check doesn't do anything for that. Our apology doesn't do anything for that.
Yeah.
It takes an understanding. An apology comes from an understanding of a heart that has a brain to execute. And when you execute an apology, it means that you have acknowledged your actions and you will change those actions. Unfortunately, we haven't heard any apologies for any atrocities to date that has actually come to the heart that changed their actions to produce that type of healing that we continue to talk about, you know, that cliche of healing.
Yeah.
You know? So, Randy, once again, amazing job you've been doing. I'm glad you found yourself because in finding yourself, I believe that you're helping so many people out there, our brothers and sisters, to get their word out and in an articulate way.
Yeah.
That is, I'm going to tell you, I saw the film last night and I'm smiling ear to ear. It is.
Oh, good.
It is a professional film of any standard of any film I've ever saw, and I love the message, and I love Walter. I've come to love Walter, and anyone that sees the film will also come to love Walter and Maria when they hear the stories behind these amazing survivors.
Oh, great.
No, please go ahead.
Oh, yeah, just one little announcement. We begin educational distribution only of the DVD next month. For more information, for contact, you can go to www.thickdarkfog.com. And if you're interested in it, I can send you the link to do a PayPal purchase. It's $250 for institutions, for educational institutions, treatment programs, and the like. And those funds that we raise right away will go into finishing our post-production. We still need to pay for some things to get it ready for broadcast on PBS, which will reach not just the hundreds of film festivals, but the millions on television that a television audience can provide. So we're trying to get our biggest audience as we can. So, So when it comes on in the fall, yeah.
I love that you guys are actually it's being released first to institutional and educational, because it's exactly what it is. You did this work to educate. You know?
It's a tool, yeah. It's an educational tool, and then, like I see, you get some kind of art and entertainment out of it too. Hopefully,
yeah. And then hopefully we'll be seeing that on PBS in the fall time, correct?
In the fall, yeah. It's the fall is a long time, but there'll be updates. Maybe we can talk. I understand you may have Walter and Jane on the show, and you know we'll all be in touch. We'll all be in touch with. With each other, and you'll be getting updates.
That would be awesome, and I definitely want to extend to you that you always have a mic here on Fire Talk
Thank
Production.
Thank you. I appreciate you, folks.
You're an amazing man. You're telling an amazing story, and you're bringing people into our lives that we continue to love ourselves. I will continue to follow Walter and Maria's story, and I ask that you guys continue to do that too. And in your compassion this holiday season, I ask that you look into your heart, and that you reach out into our nations, and then you're helping warmth to people this holiday season. Please visit us at whisperandthunder.org and donate to the E-Res Fund. We have people waiting who can definitely use your kindness this year, and keep that Christmas spirit in your heart all year long. Thank you for joining us at Fire Talk, and we will see you next week. We'll be